Hi, everybody. Good afternoon, good morning, I don't know, good evening from wherever you are here with us in the virtual room, and very well welcome here in Bonn, in the auditorium in Bonn. Sorry, I knew that was going to happen. So my name is Katharin Vogel. I coordinate the GIZ Data Lab, which is an innovation and think and do tank, as we call it, to promote the fair use of responsible data for development. And with the, hype around generative AI, we've started an event series from the Data Lab on generative AI and its consequence and impact. We started with an interview with the renowned Professor Floridi, I think it was in May. And this is our second edition of the event series. And it's called Unlocking the Future, Generative AI Reshaping Development Cooperation. We're looking forward to a great discussion with our panelists, Frederica, Pelonomi, and Lane. I will introduce you properly, obviously, later. And we will have some opening remarks by Ms. Hofen. But before we start, I have to or want to give you, for those in the room, some information. The emergency exit rooms, exits are over there. And this event is live streamed and will be published on our blog, so an external blog. And if you do not want to be on the recording, there is a green zone in the back seat, so you can sit over there, and so that you will not be there. Actually, the over there it's completely full. But if you feel like coming in front, just don't worry, you're going to be fine. I've said everything I have to say, and now I want to very much welcome Ingrid Hofen to the stage to set the scene for us.
So dear colleagues, distinguished guests, it's really an honor to have you here in our campus Bonn. And of course, I also would like to welcome all those joining us virtually. So the GIZ community, thinking, working, experimenting with this topic is much bigger. It's really growing tremendously. And as we have just said, the first session that we had in May with Professor Floridi was really also highly attended by a large number of GIZ colleagues all around the world, which actually underlines first, the relevance of the subject for our core business. Secondly, I think the wish to learn more and to figure out how could it actually help us in our doing and becoming even a better organization that serves people and the planet. Let me start with a couple of remarks setting the scene. For many years already, we have been witnessing how artificial intelligence has increasingly been part of our work, also at GIZ. We see AI being used to detect plant diseases or to improve food production in rural areas. It supports the planning of mobility in cities, or it predicts climate change. We completely have got used to all the small AI applications on our computers and smartphones. But suddenly, it is everywhere in the news. Generative AI is the buzzword of today, and possibly also of tomorrow. Most of us have seen artificial images of the Pope in a spacesuit or read a poem generated by a machine. And we all, as individuals, societies, but also we as a company, try to understand. Is this a toy? A threat? A game changer? That would actually give us another push to achieve these SDGs. You all know that next week in New York is going to take place the Climate and SDG Summit. So, and we know that we are lagging behind. So much is missing, and people are starting to suffer even more from the impact of climate change. Is this just a trend, something fashionable that's going to pass, and we continue to go back to some traditional tools and ways of using knowledge? What I do observe so far, a few nations and enterprises lead the development of these technologies. But the impact is global. Operating in international development cooperation means for us that we have to see both the opportunities and the challenges for all societies worldwide. What are the opportunities? The hopes for generative AI for sustainable development are fast. It might be a virtual teacher where human resources are scarce, or assist with tailored online education. It might boost economic growth as the technology helps individuals to write or produce assets like music, movies, and with far less resources than before. Open source chatbots and virtual assistants may help bridge the digital divide more than any other technology ever has. And especially the potential for health systems and medical research is enormous, and we have seen so many articles about this subject the last couple of weeks and months. However, alongside these opportunities, they come significant challenges. I don't want to join all these apocalyptic scenarios in headlines saying that AI will take over the world with the potential to destroy humanity, as in my opinion, this actually distracts from the immediate dangers right in front of us that we have to deal with. Get prepared to use the technology properly. And those threats or challenges, let's frame it like this, are first, non-representative training data. Unfortunately, a reality as they mainly come from the global north, and this can cause a huge bias, discrimination, and misinformation. Second point is access to models and computing power remains concentrated in the global north and widening the digital inequality. And it may actually concentrate power in specific enterprises too. And I think so far we haven't actually figured out what does this mean in practice for democracies, for individuals in deciding about our data, for what it is going to be used. And this is due to the fact that we don't have sufficient existing regulations or frameworks that would actually somehow make clear for what, under which circumstances, AI is being used and what are the rights of individuals in this new world. And of course, we have seen what fake news can do to democracies, also in our own country. So imagine, I mean, the new tool, it's so imaginative how democratic processes and governments can be weakened by disinformation. And this may amplify political tensions in societies. And the requirements, of course, for skills, competencies, education will change radically. With generative AI, the future of work is in a transformation, that's for sure. And possibly leading to job losses in some areas, profiles are going to be changed. And this may cause a new divide, because perhaps not all people and individuals will be fit for the new types of jobs and opportunities that AI may create in the global market. And we have seen that in some circumstances, especially also in the global south, that we also have to take care about and have to think about poor working conditions when it comes to AI. And here and there, we have already heard about digital sweatshops, exploitation of workers in the global south to fill the systems with the data that is required. And finally, last but not least at all, today is the 15th of September, you are here, you are not on the climate strike. You may have joined perhaps in the morning, but nevertheless, it's the day of the climate strike. It's also very important to see what kind of CO2 footprint those technologies have and how we are going to compensate for it. So, what is the way forward? There are many actors in this vast evolving ecosystem, and each of them has different roles. I firmly believe that international development, and as such GIZ, must play an active part in this field. As convener, solution builder, advisor, or enabler of capacity building. Our guiding principle should be the cooperation with the Global South must be core and center, not an afterthought. We need to actively involve our partners in the whole discourse around AI, especially those with fewer resources, but also the ones that are already advanced. They should be part of the journey from the very beginning, bring in own aspects, own ideas, and own needs. Access to data and to models and computing power for our partners is absolutely essential. And I've just addressed the capacity building needs that the new technology actually requires. And additionally, and this is something that we try to address more and more in our own programs, are actually the regulatory deficits that we observe around the world and that are being right now already exploited by those that would like to take advantage for being the first movers, the first to enter those markets. So to sum up, I think this is an important subject for us to improve our not only efficiency but effectiveness, especially in our doing. I think I see there are huge opportunities that we should seize. But much more at the strategic or macro level, I think we should really bear in mind, does the technology really improve sustainable development? Is it something that may push social justice, or is it another hurdle that we have to overcome? And what about sustainability issues? It shouldn't be something that we address thereafter, but it has to be addressed in parallel. And let me add two additional individual thoughts that I have. I think what is so important and what is so much needed when we see how much turmoil we confront around the world, in our own societies, in the Global South, when people become skeptical about change and transformation, I think what we really need are approaches, even when we address new technologies, that are people-centered. Departing what people actually need, what they would like to see as their own perspective and vision for their livelihoods. And I think this can be combined. The people-centered approach brings us back for what we are here for, and it brings us back to what societies have to deliver, after all. And of course, this also goes hand in hand with one of the SDG principles, and we leave no one behind. Quite essential, and I think this is more needed than ever. I'm so curious now to listen to this amazing panel and to your questions. I wish us all an exciting afternoon here on Friday, 15th of September in Bonn. Thank you so much again for being here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Ingrid, for perfectly setting the scene and actually mentioning many of the things we're going to talk about now. We start with an introduction of the panelists. I want to start with you, Polinomi. We know you, we've known you, like being in this from the scene. Now, a lot of people know you because you've just recently been elected as one of the 100 most important and influential people in AI by the Time magazine, so congratulations for that. And we're very happy to have you here. So Polynomi, you are the CEO of Lelapa AI. It's a company from South Africa delivering and developing local solutions, AI-based solutions in Africa for Africans, by Africans, facing African problems. And you are drawn to the curiosities of community and connection and in how they can inform imaginings of a better future. You have almost 10 years of experience in productionalizing machine learning solutions in financing and other industries. You have biomedical and electrical engineering degrees with a Master of Science in Engineering from Tohoku University in Japan. And you were, apart from being one of the most 100 influential people in AI by the Time magazine, as one of 200 young South Africans in 2019 by the Mail and Guardian and the Bloomberg Catalyst list in 2023. And you're also an incredible TED speaker on AI. So Polynomi, what we have experienced in the last 9 months, so to say, what is this the start of a new era? What would you say?
Guessing, yeah, this is on. Cool. Is this the start of a new era?
Yeah.
I would like to believe so, you know, otherwise, what am I doing with my life? But I also genuinely believe that the motivations around the technology that we have available to us today are from a singular perspective. And if we really do want to reflect the collective intelligence of what humans are able to achieve, then we need more points of view within that imagining. And I'm quite excited by what that means and what the people in the rest of the world have to offer in terms of moving technology in a direction that is better for more people.
Thank you, Frederica. Very warm welcome also to you. Frederica Kaltheuner, you have spent the last decade working on technology policy, emerging technology and rights, advising the Vice President of the European Commission, funding civil society organizations in Europe to build their capacity in AI, and until recently, just recently, build up the Technology and Rights Division at Human Rights Watch. You're also the editor of the Fake AI book about technological hype. So, Frederica, what do you mean by AI, and what is hype, and what's genuine progress?
So I think when I think back on the last 9 months, the three words that come to mind is, on the one hand, genuine excitement, mm-hmm. on the one hand, at the very tangible progress that we could all experience. I wrote a love letter using ChatGPT in December. Also excitement that while there's a lot of progress to be made, more voices are being centered and companies like yours are getting recognition. I think that's exciting. At the same time, I feel like the last 9 months were exasperating. And they were exasperating because we have been through a hype cycle on AI in the past. We've come out of it with a much more nuanced perspective of what the technology can and cannot do. Of course, this has changed a little bit, but it very much feels like we're back into the full-blown hype mode, where a lot of the discussions that we had a year ago are just coming back. And that means sort of if you work on human rights and governments, that's sort of like governments who want to use AI for purposes that the technology simply isn't fit to serve. The very persistent return of also pseudoscientific applications, like the return of race science to things like ethnicity recognition, and I'm just using scare quotes because this is just something that AI cannot do. And then finally, I think, and I'm very glad that this was mentioned in the introduction, so I'm genuinely excited, I'm a bit exasperated, but I'm also concerned, and I think if the goal is sustainable, equitable international cooperation, then the speed at which the recent hype, but also real progress in AI, is leading to a concentration of power is a real concern. And last week I was at a conference with AI researchers from Europe, And it was really mind-boggling to listen to them do the math to explain why they absolutely cannot compete with large language models and the foundation models that companies like OpenAI offer. And this is Europe, right? This isn't the majority world, this is Europe, and these researchers just said, we absolutely cannot compete. So we can talk about this more, but this is sort of the how I would describe the current moment from my perspective.
Thank you, Friederike. So Lane, very welcome also to you. Lane Dilk from OpenAI, you lead the government, the Global Government Partnership at OpenAI, and you support governments around the world confronting challenges in areas including education, health, climate change, and resilience. Your past work includes advising the United States Executive Office of the President and Department of Energy and leadership on investment in clean energy technologies. You managed a city through the COVID-19 pandemic, drafted and defended precedents setting public health and affordable housing, and you worked in worker protection laws. You also counseled leadership of a global public research university and developed privacy and cybersecurity policy. Lane, when we were talking before for the event, you were saying like people refer to OpenAI as big tech and you start laughing. So can you explain a little bit why you're laughing when they talk about big tech when it comes to OpenAI, and also like tell us a little bit of, you know, being kind of like in the center of the storm, how your last 9 months felt like?
Sure. You know, I think OpenAI, there is a misperception. We often are referred to as big tech, and it is true that we laugh every time, in part because we are a company of 500, maybe 600 people this week. But I think that what is central to our ethic and central to who we are as an entity really is our foundation as a research and development lab and our commitment to our mission and charter. And moving forward with that, the we do have a governance structure that is, we are governed by a nonprofit board of directors, and that is important to who we are. I think, though, the most important thing and the reason that that I and we are here today is we are an entity that is really focused on learning and really focused on collaboration and very focused on being in conversation about what this moment in human history means. As you mentioned, my background is actually not in tech. My background is in government and public service. And in, you know, as I look at democratic institutions and governments, and I actually will tell a quick story, which is that in 2021, at a low point in the pandemic where I was in particular, I read a report by the National Intelligence Council from the United States looking forward to 2040 and talking about what the largest challenges that we would face would be. And what this report keyed in on, even in the first few sentences, was the scale and magnitude of the challenges that the human race would face between now and 2040. The potential inability of democratic institutions to rise up to meet those challenges, and the public consternation that would result from that gap. And I think we have seen that confluence of factors coming together in many different ways. And for me, I do have optimism, though cautious optimism, about the ability of these systems and these tools to move us forward to address some of these challenges. I think, though, what has been said already is absolutely correct. And interestingly, what this report also said was, the future is very much in our hands. And I say that not to be trite, but literally to say all of human history is individuals and overlapping communities. And it is very much up to us to determine the course and trajectory of what comes next.
Thank you. Thank you very much for also looking at already providing your hope And so let's take this on and talk about the opportunities. So I'd like to start again with you, Polinomi. You are one of the key players when it comes to strengthening the local AI system and ecosystem in the Global South and Africa. And so when you think of this, what are your hopes? Do you join in Lane's statement? What do you think of the opportunities of what is happening or how it has happened in the last couple of months?
Yeah, I think my hope is multifaceted. Part of my hope means that I have severe limitations in recognizing some of the challenges. I'm very optimistic about specifically how people-centered, human-centered AI that is specifically created in order to address the needs of people has the potential and opportunity to create a world for us that genuinely helps us be better people, not just to ourselves, but to other people that we share the world with and to the other things that we share this world with. But I think my hopes are specifically from a Global South perspective is to learn from the Global North, you know. I think there are a number of things that the majority world can learn in terms of not doing things the way they have been done. And I think part of that is around like the lack of resource efficiency that we have seen going into developing the technology of today. And us in a resource-constrained environment have this opportunity, firstly, to protect ourselves to a certain extent from that exploitation because we don't have the data, we don't have the energy, we don't have that kind of internet connection. But also at the same time develop different ways of creating this technology that everyone else can learn from in a way that is able to use resources sparingly so that there's enough left for everyone. I think where this is also quite important is this idea of distributed power. In this opening address by Ingrid and Friederike touched on it earlier, these concentrations of power within certain institutions is quite a worrying and dangerous thing, especially when it comes to terms with what our democracies now and in the future are having to deal with. But through the nature of low resource learnings and low resource development, there's just this opportunity for that power to reflect the communities and the users for whom that technology is made. And yeah, I'm just super excited about technology actually addressing people's needs as well. I think up until this point, the main drivers of AI technology and the main success stories are around commercialization and driving capital means and entertainment. And I can't wait until the point where it's really solving problems on the ground and really addressing issues of inequalities, especially within the majority world.
Thank you, Polinomi. Lane, would you agree, and what could the role of OpenAI be in that to foster that and support that?
Yes, I definitely do agree and think that, you know, there are a number of different ways where I think it's incredibly important that we collaborate, and we've talked a little bit about low-resource languages and collaborations there. But I think more importantly, you know, as I mentioned, one of the reasons I wanted to be here today is because we are such a small entity, in some ways that does give us opportunity to be working with partners and working genuinely with partners who are in the majority world to truly understand where should we be going, how should we be getting there, and to bring that thinking in as we expand. So, you know, we are in many ways looking at a fresh slate in terms of the way we are going to work together and exploring that now and trying to understand how we can best do that together. I also do really appreciate your point, Polinomi, about the nature of the technology. It is, in my view at least, different from some other recent technologies in that it is a problem-solving technology. And I think that was the perception of other large leaders in the beginning, and it's really important that we work together to hold on to that and that the technology be useful and beneficial to human lives. I think the potential is extraordinary as long as we keep our motivations focused really and truly on those uses and uses that are truly useful in the world. I think that there is incredible opportunity to work together.
Elaine and Frederica, what about you? Your thoughts on the genuinely positive impacts of that and potential for humankind?
I mean, I work on technology because I am fascinated by it and I believe that it can have tremendously positive impact. What is progress and what is a positive impact? I think that's the important question. Learning from the last hype cycle, there was and sort of just to distinguish, these are narrowly defined, the last hype cycle, those were AI systems that were built for narrowly defined tasks versus general purpose AI that we're talking about now. But what was really fascinating, and that is a persistent problem, is that news reports, including The Guardian, really reputable newspapers, tend to report progress in AI in terms of this system has 99% accuracy, 78% accuracy. And in the book I edited with lots of interesting AI experts, there was a really important essay on the importance of benchmark data sets. We really need to, as actors in this space, become more literate and develop more expertise in very critically interrogating what accuracy, what progress means. I think that's a general point, like what is progress? The conflation between what a technology actually can do and what it cannot do is so important, or because it leads to real tangible harm, especially in the public sector. Governments have a tendency to be especially susceptible to smaller companies, vendors, whoever, who just sell, ride the hype wave and sell technology to solve problems that the technology simply cannot solve. So this is really important, and I also think who benefits is a really important question, right? So a technology, a service can be really good at solving a problem, but there may be externalities. And in everything we've seen in the last few years, the problem is that risks are really, really unevenly distributed. They may work for a majority of users, but they're severely discriminated against a minority. So I think this is on like, what is progress? More generally speaking, I would love to challenge a bit the idea sort of OpenAI as the small startup. So what does it mean to be part of big tech? Does it mean that you have tens of thousands of staff? No. But it is quite interesting. There was an analysis by the Brookings Institute on market concentration in foundation models, which concluded that there's a real concern of there being a tendency of market concentration in large language models. And for international corporations, that means if we're investing in services in companies that use AI or rely on AI as a service, we really need to ask the question, who benefits? Where does the money actually go? If the money lands in the hand of already dominant companies, that exacerbates an already problematic dynamic. Yeah, so what's progress? Now I said a really negative response, but all I want to say is I think there are enough people who hype the technology, so I always see my role as emphasizing the risks, and I think what is progress, who benefits? Those are the most important questions to ask.
Thank you, Frederica, and we will come to discuss more about the challenges and the role of the various actors, but allow me just one more question, a little bit more on the opportunities. Like, does like any of you like have a very concrete hope on any of the SDGs? Like, what do you think concretely can be done? Where can we learn? What Ingrid's also stressed, this technology help us to maybe make a big step towards 1, 2, 3, all of the SDGs? Anybody?
Okay, I'll go, because I guess the SDGs are predominantly relevant in my context. And as a language startup, and a language startup in the low resource space in the global south, for us, the SDGs are kind of just like a side to what we're trying to do. I'm not saying this in a problematic way. I'm saying this because the SDGs are a core component of how we develop what we need to develop. So to us, we're developing access to technology. We're bridging the digital divide through language. So on the African continent, I think 65% of people live in rural areas, which means that of sub-Saharan Africa. So that means around 65% making a generalization, but don't necessarily engage in technology with the languages to which technology supports. In South Africa, yes, a lot of people speak English, but only 8% of South Africans speak English as a first home language. So automatically, when you have products and services, and increasingly so, being made available through technology, and that technology is often textual via language, it means that, in the South African context, you're barring 90% of the people there from accessing a global market. And so for us, there is a direct relationship between us enabling people to engage with their technology by supporting their languages, and that resulting in to impacting SDGs, whether that be people having better access to healthcare, people having better access to education, decreasing poverty where people are able to access a global network and increase economic flow. There's just so much that we're able to assist in addressing and empowering local businesses on the ground to do what they need to do better so that they can solve the problems more.
I think I would agree with that. I think most of our work is focused on what are the use cases that will advance education, that will advance smallholder farming, how can we use this technology to bring knowledge bases to individuals and to communities in that way. But the language work is absolutely essential and foundational to the ability to bring those benefits.
And to build on this, as you said earlier, there's nothing inevitable in the way in which we build and develop technology. So also, I want to emphasize that some of the criticism or concerns, they are related to the current moment. And it could also be, we need to democratize the field. We need to, there are ways to address the challenges. And that will allow us to also reap the benefits.
Thank you. So Elaine, we heard a little bit about the challenges already and power imbalances, and et cetera, et cetera. So what is your take? What does OpenAI do, or does OpenAI do to mitigate the challenges and to better support and seize the opportunities?
Yes, I think OpenAI looks at it in a few different ways. One of the things that I do want to point to is just that the corporate structure is at this point a capped profit structure, which I mention only because in terms of capital flow, it is a structure where actually the benefits flow to a nonprofit at a particular point to the extent we end up in what I think many of us would fear would be a worst case scenario on that perspective. I think as we look at the risks, we're focused on safety, security, and trust. And I think we're focused on those both in terms of the technology right now and frontier models. So looking at how do regulations and how do policy platforms address the current risks and impacts of the models, and then also looking at what does it mean as the models get more powerful. So on that second part, a lot of the work we're doing now is trying to ensure that we have common language to speak with about risks, about independent evaluations, red teaming, and other safety mechanisms, and also to make sure that those very policy conversations about frontier models are also looking at this question of who benefits and how, and is the technology actually producing meaningful improvements in lives globally, trying to bring that into the policy conversation as well.
Frederica, you were mentioning the challenges before. Would you say that it's just like the same challenges we've had in the first hype cycle, or is this something completely new and we have to develop new solutions and new answers to that?
So I would distinguish between challenges to rights that directly result from applications. That's one category. The second one is sort of the supply chain, environmental impact, working conditions of people, training data. And then the third one, and I talk about this so much because I feel it's a bit overlooked often, is sort of like these broader geopolitical power shifts. So those are the three categories. I think the first one, I'm not going to repeat them. It's well documented. So challenges with accuracy, with bias, with discrimination, transparency. What I found really fascinating in my work in a human rights organization was that sometimes the most severe harm can come from an Excel sheet. Like, we do not need complex AI in order to cause harms. And the reasons for this are complex. Sometimes we documented automation of cash transfers. Well-intentioned, potentially cost-saving, delivering services to the poorest of the poor. The challenge, however, is if this isn't done properly, if it isn't audited, it leads to new exclusions, and they're new because they're so hard to challenge and they're so insidious. So we don't need technology to discriminate, but what the research we did on my former colleague Amos Toe did on cash transfers in Jordan, what it showed was people just felt the system is arbitrary, it isn't fair, but it needs a year-long investigation by a human rights researcher to document that. And this is just one cash transfer program in one country. Long story to say, I think this isn't high-tech. We weren't even able to fully, like, it's complex what technology was even used, but this is definitely not generative AI. But those are already the problems we were documenting with a lot less complex systems. What then generative AI or more complex techniques add is an additional level of complexity, and the consequence is less transparency and less accountability. So in all contexts, policing, countries that don't even have data protection laws, no enforcement, mass surveillance, severe human rights abuses, the risk is always that it exacerbates existing problems. I think there's now a lot more attention on the environmental impact on the supply chain. That's good. What has changed here is that generative AI has changed the nature of work that people do who train models. So in the past, this was the work of sort of images that people had to click, does someone have their eyes open or closed? Mm-hmm. But as we go into large language models, the work becomes much more similar of that of content moderators who have to review extremely traumatizing content. So that's new. And then I think what is really new is this third category of the power shifts. And again, it's not just even that, not even governments, like this is really, it's a handful of companies that really hold the cards here. And I think that's definitely something to watch. And concentration of power is always a dangerous thing to keep a close watch on.
Pelonomi, do you want to add to that from your local perspective on the power imbalances and the geopolitical also situation?
The geopolitical situation has been one of the major unexpected challenges that I've come across in terms of creating an AI startup. And I think people are very aware of the technical challenges within the majority world around data, around power, around compute, but they are not as well aware of the way the world is set up just for places like Africa to not succeed from a business perspective. So in terms of money flow, in terms of incorporating companies, in terms of gaining legitimacy, those things have been very difficult. But also on the other side of this, I think I am an eternal optimist. And part of that optimism, Friederike earlier talked about, like, how do you compete with this big tech? And my answer to that is that you play a different game, in my company and in the development circles that I'm in, you know, the L for LLM for us doesn't stand for large, it stands for little. Because there's so much power in a little language model. Not only is it far more transparent, not more you're able to understand what is happening with it, and therefore you can put them into like an ensemble in order to solve problems in the way that big ones can, but then you're also just dealing with resources from a different perspective. So you require less data, you're just being a bit smarter about how your model works. And for us, this really does seem like a way to make things better. And I know that there is an obsession around this generalization of models being able to solve all the things, but I don't think that's the way. For many of the reasons that we're discussing as potential threats and disadvantages. But yeah, that's what I have to add on to that.
Thank you. So we already talked, I mean, I really like that you always stress the optimism and the hope. So let's look a little bit the way forward. So what does this mean? What can we do? And like, what kind of, how do we have to work on it? But first I'd like to come a little bit back to us as GIZ, as like just a character of the organization we are in. We work on knowledge, we provide knowledge, we provide information, we have expertise technically and methodologically. But now a lot is being done, generated by a machine. Like, what does this mean for a company based on knowledge? It's like, do we even have to fear that we become irrelevant?
I think if any conversation proves that you're relevant and that these are challenging questions that will require a lot of human effort for a very long time, I think this conversation does. You know, I think there's no question but that our tools today can enhance research, can enhance analytical work, can enhance, can help people to produce first drafts, to brainstorm ideas, to think through, you know, where difficulties or obstacles may lie with a particular project management or with a particular project. But I think that the work of global cooperation, of human-to-human interaction, of bringing these pieces together, of understanding what is the right path for language models, be they large or little, how do we think about those things? I think there is such a tremendous amount of work to be done. So I think we see transformation potentially of the way that we work. I think the core aspects of our work in some ways are heightened, elevated, and more visible through this.
What would be the to-dos now for a company like GIZ on like now that we better use the opportunity in knowledge generation, etc.?
I think in terms of specific to-dos, and it is funny, I do that work with ChatGPT quite often. You know, what is my first draft of a way of approaching a problem? I think in terms of specific to-dos, I do think we are all right now in this learning phase. And so I appreciate that you have brought us together today to have this conversation. I do believe these conversations are deeply meaningful. I think that the global engagement in conversation is very important right now. I think that as we continue to move forward, experimentation with different models and really understanding in your work how to truly engage local communities across all of your work in these questions, and to use projects as testing grounds for bringing communities in, not a testing of does the technology work for this particular use case, but real collaboration and really bringing communities into the question of what does it mean, and then researching and evaluating results. Was this a project that was successful? Did the technology actually improve the project, or did it detract from it? I think all of that work is incredibly important, as are the long-term advocacy and questions around many of the questions that Polonomy just raised, which, you know, what is the role of a large language model or a little language model? I think those become more pressing, potentially as early as a year from now. How are we looking at that, and what is your role in that, I think is also a really important question.
Frederick, you stressed many times that it's important that for you, like, everybody benefits from this technology. What can we as GIZ do to support this, and what does everybody need to do to support this? So again, looking at to-dos.
I think I was quite surprised that I think in your last question, that there's sort of in the air the question, we are a knowledge organization, we're a knowledge company, is this a threat to us? Because it doesn't even occur to me that it is, because the challenges in the world are so complex, and large language models can help with efficiency and task and summarizing, but there's like nowhere close to replacing the work that we do, that you do. I'm taking out my notes because I find this point the most important one. I loved doing a deep dive on the GIZ website on the work that you're already doing, because I think there is so much optimism and so much to do, and you're really well positioned to play a very important role. I think a strength are values and principles. Those are exactly the ones we need. So the words were like people-centered, digital transformation that leaves no one behind, increase the impact, reduce existing inequalities. Like, those are the norms and values that we need. I think it makes a lot of sense to focus on strategies to build local ecosystems. And I underemphasized that point earlier because I wanted to talk about the market concentration, but you're absolutely right. I think there's digital transformation as a broader task that is by far not complete. There's so much to do. Then there's the very large AI field in which there are so many different ways of doing AI, and then there are large language models and generative AI. So the whole spectrum is important. I also think GIZ is uniquely positioned to really invest in infrastructure. And that means talent, data, computational power that companies need to compete, and that also regions and countries need to be sovereign. So I think projects like the Fair Forward work, like, they're really good projects that I think are, like, there's a need for more of these. Yeah, and I think just my only warning would be, it's complex and it's all interconnected. And again, the research I mentioned earlier, the challenges here that we saw in the automation of a public service, the problems weren't inherent in the automation. The automation just amplified all the other existing problems that were there. So rule of law, like a lack of regulation, and sort of like, I think that's really, really important to see this holistically and not just focus on the specific task that a technology solves. Yeah. So I'm very optimistic.
Thank you so much. And I'm sure we all are happy to hear that. And glad you mentioned Fair Forward, one of our flagships financed by BMZ, which is doing an incredible job on including local languages in the AI system and more. So now a question on the governance frameworks. I mean, this is a question which has been mentioned a couple of times, and it's been discussed a lot, obviously. And I'd love to hear from like the three of you, actually, what kind of governance frameworks we need, which can still promote on the innovation, which can lead to an increased or a better impact regarding the SDGs, while addressing the risk and mitigating the risks. I don't know who wants to go first. Lane.
Yes, our answer may actually, my answer may be the least interesting here. I think OpenAI has been really clear from the beginning when increased attention focused after the release of ChatGPT in November, we've been very clear that we believe that global governance and global cooperation is absolutely essential. And Sam Altman, our CEO, went on sort of a global listening tour in part to inform those conversations, but also to understand how do we seek as OpenAI to support and facilitate that. So I think we are, you know, focused on the traditional mechanisms for international cooperation, certainly the G20, the UN, but also are doing everything we can to try to emphasize how critical it is that we get to global cooperation quickly in this space. And I think an ongoing challenge that you know, would be very interesting to hear other perspectives on too.
Looking at me expectingly. This question can be quite a tricky question to answer. I have an NGO called the Ungovernable, so you can imagine my stance on on governance and how useful it is within our context in terms of protecting us and providing us with what we need in order to enact the impact that we want to do. And I think from the global majority perspective, that is often the case. Our legal structures and government structures are very much occupied with supporting other needs. And so things like this often get left on the back burner. But that's not to say that we necessarily want or should have external institutions coming in to sweep in and save us and tell us what we need, because chances are that they don't know. I think what would be super useful from a governance perspective and globally is somebody to figure out how to do wealth redistribution, you know, so that we're able to maintain integrity in the work that we do, and so that we're able to create technology that can make lives better without worrying about certain components being more powerful than others. But I mean, this is not a terribly useful answer. So I think more directly, what we need is protections from exploitation. So particularly in the African context, a lot of the resources required for these technologies come from our soil and from our earth. And up until this point, we've been quite heavily exploited and not reaping the benefits of the extraction of those materials to build A 100s to train these machines, or to get the uranium for a nuclear power plant, or the lithium for batteries of different technologies. And that is something we very much need, because we've been exploited for a long time, and that will continue to be exasperated given the technological demands of the future. That is one. Another huge threat we're under, and we've spoken about it before, is the fake news and incorrect news and the delegitimization of democracy. Africa in many instances has unstable regions that are under threat and continue to be under threat through misinformation, which is not helpful, and we definitely do need those as well. And then aside from that, of course, all of these protections around security and privacy and the ill implications of what technology could create. If anybody really needs protecting in the world, it's those who are most vulnerable, and those who are most vulnerable in a majority sense come from the majority world. So there's a lot that needs to happen, but for me, the way is not very clear, so I don't talk about it very often.
Thank you for that, like, really broad picture, and for mentioning all these dimensions, which is super helpful bringing these additional dimensions into the discussion. Thanks, Polonomi. Frederica, same question to you.
I wanted you to go first because I wanted to hear your perspective. It's a really important reminder. If you work for rights organizations, you spend half your time fighting really problematic regulation, especially on tech. My sense is that globally, tech regulation has become a tool of oppression. And I'm thinking, I'm not speaking about AI regulation, I'm speaking about content regulation. So throughout the world, we see incredibly problematic laws against misinformation, where misinformation means anybody who doesn't agree with me. So always keep that in mind. We need regulation, but it has to be rights compliant, it has to be good regulation. And we have to keep in mind that there are contexts where there is a general problem with the rule of law and enforcement, and it is quite complex. So that's just sort of as an aside. And then more specifically, AI isn't happening in a vacuum, right? And I think it is no coincidence that the large tech companies are dominating AI. So all of the other regulatory questions and debates of the last year remain relevant and important. So data governance, AI uses data. So all the questions remain on the agenda. And then I think I would think about it in terms of we need rules to tackle the various risks and harms that stem from the direct use of AI systems. Someone like Deborah Raj, she's a US-based, really incredible AI researcher. She said a few weeks ago, if companies cannot guarantee that communities aren't harmed, the question we should ask ourselves, like, should these tools exist or should they be released? So I think the general question is, especially because harms are so unevenly distributed, is it really okay to just release models and then regulate after the fact? So we need binding laws for AI, for rules to tackle discrimination, all these issues, in a risk-based way, where we also need to talk about there are certain risks that are unacceptable. And I think sort of the examples I Nuremberg agreed on is like remote biometric identification. It's unacceptable because it changes the way that public space works. So specific AI regulation, then another regulatory discussion is to tackle all these supply chain issues. These are often then sectoral regulation. In Europe, we have the Platform Worker Directive, which is really interesting. It hasn't received much attention, but it regulates platform work, delivery drivers, click work. This is really important. And then to tackle the broader questions, there's antitrust. There are questions about market dominance that may be tackled with these instruments. And globally, I'm really interested in how do we really make sure that this benefits everyone? That's a really broad discussion that goes into power and geopolitics. So lots of different policy fields are involved. There are very few people who are deep experts in all of them. I'm certainly not. And the risk is that these regulations happen completely out of sync. And I think Europe is seen as the de facto regulator on tech, but it's also incredibly complex how the AI Act interacts with other regulations. So there are also some risks there because rules are one thing, but the rules also need to be effectively enforced. And if it gets so complicated that nobody understands them anymore, it is neither good for rights, not good for business. So, yeah.
And like looking at what is being discussed right now, would you say we're on the right track? Or is it too complicated to talk about it, to build your opinion, or what would you say?
Do you mean in Europe on regulation?
Yeah, Europe in general.
I think in Europe, I'm missing the vision. Like, what is the end goal? Where do we want to be? And that's because different commissioners are responsible for different files, and they're not always moving in the same direction. But I think generally, I'm also actually an optimist. That's why I work on this topic. I think we've never been better positioned to talk about really good tech regulation than now, because there is a lot of expertise. There are now researchers and academics. I mentioned a few who've been working on this for 7-8 years. So yes, there may have been progress in a specific field of AI, but there is so much expertise. And that means, yeah, we're in a really good place to find good solutions. What worries me is who's in the room and who's speaking. Especially the meetings we saw in the US. Of course, companies, we need to listen to them, they need to be there, but companies cannot dominate the discussion because nobody wants to regulate themselves. It's just, we need more people who do not have a vested interest in the discussions.
Pelonomi, Ingrid has stressed the role of partnerships. And what would you wish from a company like GIZ, but also from a company like OpenAI, to in terms of partnerships?
I like how Frederica had her notes prepared and was, and I'm like, oh man, I should have prepared for this question. I think, you know, partnerships are such an important part of the power distribution, and understanding how communities work together is a really, really important process to making sure that this tech works for us. I was at the Deep Learning Indaba last week, which is a really huge AI conference for Africans held on the African continent, and a member on a trustworthy AI panel said that, and referring to your point earlier, that the metrics of machines don't matter. It doesn't matter if your machine is getting 99%. Who determines the success of your model is the community. They're the ones who decide whether it's a good model or not. And I think I really liked your answer earlier, Elaine, with regards to GIZ having this network of understanding or having presence in particular communities. And I think that could be an amazing relationship from like a social science perspective of understanding the impact of particular projects within within particular areas. And when I say communities, I don't mean like just a little village, you know, like these ecosystems of groups of people, and understanding what the impact is so that there is a full feedback loop into the cycle of human-centered development. And in fact, I think we've already started this journey with companies like OpenAI, and I do want to say thanks to OpenAI because the other tech companies just come to us and want our data. But there has been conversations around how we can work together in order to create collaborations for the evaluation and capability understanding of models being developed by them within our context. And I think those kinds of partnerships and relationships help to make tech better for everybody, and in a way that makes sure it just works. Yeah, I think those are two examples of how that relationship can be facilitated in a way that's helpful.
Thank you. Do you have anything to add there, as you have been mentioned a couple of times?
No, I think I would echo that, this will sound trite, in order to do this, we have to do it together. But I don't mean that tritely. I really mean we do not, we are often referred to as the quote experts, but core to our ethic is valuing the expertise of others and collaborating and partnering in order to ensure that we are not just bringing in other voices, but actually collaborating in the way that we are both developing and deploying our technology.
Thank you. So I'm done with my questions, but I know that there are many more. Just for your information, we have like almost 800 people in the virtual room. So thank you for joining again. We can open the floor for questions to our panelists. Are there questions in the room we can start with? Yes, okay, maybe you can stand up so the panelists can see you and present yourself, and maybe even if you wish, direct your question to one of the three.
Thanks, is this on? Okay, cool. Hi, my name is Daniel. I'm with the Fair Forward program that was mentioned earlier. And I really liked, Frederick, your point when you sort of put generative AI a little bit into perspective to say there's such a range of AI, machine learning and all of it. And now the hype is on generative AI, but it's also just a tool. And it sometimes feels like whenever there's a tool that speaks.
Can you speak up a little? Yeah,
like this?
Exactly.
Okay,
well,
sorry.
That's better.
I'm not used to using microphones. It sometimes feels like whenever there's a tool that speaks to people the way that they speak, they feel like it's going to overtake the world. And when I say they speak, obviously it means they speak in majority world languages. And point I wanted to make is around Now I'm losing my track of thought. Sorry, just a second. It's around, obviously, there's a lot of potential for, it's less about the tool, but more about the underlying power dynamics and the underlying power structures that exist, and that a tool like AI, generative AI, can amplify, can exacerbate, and I think that came out very clearly also in the discussions, but it also is a tool that can have a lot of positive impact if we do it the right way. And we as Fear Forward, we believe that, together with our partners in countries like South Africa, that one way to address these power imbalances is by democratizing and by open sourcing AI, whilst at the same time there's a tension between open source AI and responsible AI. What data can be open sourced, what data should maybe not be open sourced, and what does it mean? There's a whole discussion going on at the moment that is super interesting, and I just wanted to get sort of your perspective, your thoughts on open sourcing AI. I mean, OpenAI has it in the name, of course, but I'm also particularly interested maybe in Polynomi and your thoughts, or Frederica's, your thoughts on that question and on this tension between open source AI and responsible AI. Thanks.
Thank you. Maybe Polynomi.
Okay. I really liked that note about people being obsessed with technology that looks like them. Just a side little adventure. I'm not an academic, so I don't know how to quote people's names and things like that, but there was a study done on primates, being one of the only animals in the animal kingdom who get obsessed with their own reflections. And I think it's quite funny that humans are so obsessed with technology that mimic the characteristics that they have. So that was a funny point. But yes, on the component of open sourcing, I think it's a very complicated question. And I don't think it's a yes or no answer. And the reason why I say that is for two reasons. So one of which, from a company perspective, functioning in a capital world and having to generate income, open sourcing is a limitation on IP. And if we want to be competitive, it means protecting IP, but that is directly in conflict with making sure that that information is available. The second aspect around open sourcing, and especially from the global majority perspective, is around data. And this idea that if we just make data freely available, it opens us up for exploitation. So then a company is able to take that data, use it, create the product, and sell it back to us. It sounds familiar. It's happened before in many different industries. So that is another issue around open sourcing. But, you know, the benefits of open sourcing are supremely strong, you know, especially in the place of the global majority where certain resources are under strain and are lacking. If we're able to share that with each other, it means that there's greater opportunity for increased development. And so there are conversations around like levels of access, who can access what at what level. However, I do think that there is one layer that should be accessible to everybody, and that's around these fairness, transparency, explainability metrics. And whether it's a data set or a model, all of that information about what is in there and how it impacts the users of the technology and the results of the technology needs to be made freely available. I mean, there are complications, because if you're doing like a full data sheet that explains the details of your data, who it affects, who it represents, et cetera, then you are revealing to a certain extent who is in that data and what is in that data, which is why it's not a yes or no answer. It's a lot more complicated than that. But yes, I'm pro open source in some ways and not pro open source in others.
So I feel this isn't, I don't build AI models. This isn't my expertise. There was recently a paper published called The Myth of Open, which I recommend reading because it questions the notion of openness. It also asks, what is open? What does openness mean? And I'd love to hear from Lane, you're probably aware of this, what your response to this is, because what the paper argues is that also from the different iterations of models, there was less and less openness. So the trend seems to be towards less. And the sort of the analysis of the paper, I don't fully recall it in my head right now, but sort of that this is just like open source software became commercialized and a move away from the way more radical free software movement, that now in AI, openness is seen as we're trustworthy because we're open. But what is it actually, what does open mean for OpenAI? I'm really curious.
I think the tensions, and I think you raised them well in your initial question, I think the tension between responsible AI as models get more powerful, and as we look at things like misinformation and disinformation and elections and other things, there is definitely a tension there. That said, I think that the points that you both have raised around transparency and explainability, what we have done to date is to try to release public research, to try to make that available broadly, to support development in all kinds of ways, but also to support safety research. And we have our system cards, which attempt to explain in the details the different models. I think we will see more of that. The Frontier Models Forum, I think, will attempt to provide more in terms of explainability. But I do think it is a tension that that we have to continue to work through and to work through in a variety of different forums.
Thank you, the three of you, actually. I'll look at the chat and I just pick out one question from Franz. I guess I know which Franz, but just says Franz. So I guess it's probably too late to. What kind of natural intelligence is required to master and make best use of artificial intelligence?
So an interesting question. I think I think I understand the phrasing. I don't think I know the answer to that. There are many questions I don't know the answer to, but I don't. I think we are learning a lot about prompt engineering and how to get the most out of the tools. But I don't know that we know the answer to that. I am very excited about the potential for different kinds of interactions with the tools. I'm a lawyer by training, and somebody said to me when I started, being a lawyer and writing code are very similar in that it's about grammar and syntax and other things, and was very helpful to me in explaining many of these pieces. But I think that linear way of thinking is actually not all that this technology is capable of responding to. So I think that we will see a lot of experimentation, and I actually really like that question and want to think about it more.
And just two sentences on it. There was a book a few years ago, Smarter Than You Think, which looked at chess computers and chess players. And there the argument was that you have, at the time maybe things have changed, but that the best players are the ones who work with a chess computer, who know chess, who work with a chess computer, and the third one was who fully understand the strengths and weaknesses of the chess computer. And I think this is why I always go back to this. We need a really, really realistic discourse about what the technology can and cannot do so that we can use it responsibly and effectively.
I like that very much. Thank you for that. Very, very nice picture. I hardly can see you. Paloma, do you want to add to that? Is there anything?
Yes. Yeah, I think I really enjoy that, the relationship thing, because AI is often posed as a us against them, as if them as an entity, but also as if the thing is not a tool. It's like a fork or a basket or a language. It's something that helps us influence our present reality and our future reality, and it's a teamwork type of thing. So when they're talking about natural intelligence, of course, the entities that exist in the world that are able to use tools in order to do that are described as us, as human beings. And by virtue of being a human being, that's really all that you need. I think
when people are like, oh, we're almost at the stage of AGI, I think there's a severe lack of understanding of exactly what intelligence is and the capacity that it exists in the human form. To think that you're able to replicate that and to think that the technology available today is a replication of that is just incorrect.
Thank you. Do we have another question in the room, Sophie? Maybe stand up, yes,
First of all, thank you very much for your session. I mean, I learned a lot. I'm Sophie, Director General for Learning and Development at GIZ. And of course, my question is also going to this direction, what you already discussed. So what are the future skills, actually? I mean, I could hear, you know, cooperating, networking, soft skills, communicating. And we also know that half-life of knowledge is becoming shorter and shorter. So what would you say, what are the three future skills that are being required required in the future? And my second question is completely different. I mean, maybe you heard that the Secretary General of the United Nations proposed or suggested having AI governance, something like the International Atomic Energy Organization. Would you like such a model to have a UN agency determining and also being responsible for AI regulations and governance?
Thank you. Any specific person you are addressing your questions to, Soki, because we won't have the time to know. Okay, so who feels called?
I can address the first one, and I apologize, the jet lag is getting to me, I'm getting clunky, so I apologize, but I do think, you know, when you ask about the skills, which I think is another way of asking about the intelligence required, I think it is more about understanding the how we use our capabilities together with the tools. So I think, for example, as we look at creativity, I mean, we think about prompt engineering sometimes in an analytical sense, but that is certainly not the only way to think of it. I mean, I think creativity will be really essential and powerful in this space. And I think in terms of global governance, just to address the second, we do favor you know, a global governance system in part to ensure that we are addressing many of the issues that have come up here. We believe that requires global cooperation, not just for the risks, but to understand the entire landscape.
I'm more skeptical about it, but the mostly about the AI framing, because all of these issues are interconnected and there is a risk that we reinvent the wheel a little bit, and that we don't connect discussions about AI. And my concern is that it narrowly focuses on, let's say, discrimination, very important, but there's a bigger picture question here. And then if you think about it, and I still find this mind-boggling, UNHCR has a team that works on technology and rights, and they're tiny. This is I'd love the UN to invest in this team, because they're, I don't know the size, but they're very, very small, and they cover all the human rights and all of the technology globally. So why a new institution? That's where the skepticism is coming from. But that said, of course we need global conversations and dialogue.
I think I tend to agree with that to a certain extent. There is definitely very specific governance that needs to happen around AI technology, but a large majority of what needs to be considered should be considered within the general operations of how we are and how we live. I think people often have the misconception that AI is about technology rather than about people and the people it affects and the communities to which it is integrated, and that it's a people problem as well as a technological one. And a lot of that people stuff is already covered by different areas. It just needs additions relevant to the AI context. And then I just wanted to say, when Lane talks about
creativity. I think people often automatically think creativity from like a writing or a painting or a musical lens. And I would like to ensure that that definition, even just from an audience perspective, is expanded to like a problem-solving creativity as well. Like you can have a really cool, fancy model, but if you don't know how to use it, what it needs in combination with in order to achieve the thing you want to achieve, it's not going to work. And understanding how that functions within people and within groups of people and within society needs a human. The computer doesn't know how to do that. And yeah, there's just things at this moment that computers cannot solve. A lot of them political. and to understand how to apply those kinds of technical solutions in ways that are helpful requires a person with that context, with that knowledge, to use it as a tool, like a fork to eat your fries. I don't know. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Actually, looking at the time, I know we have many more questions. I have to actually end the discussion, but do not want to end it in general without giving Ingrid the chance for some closing remarks.
I think the first thing that we should do actually is that we should give a big, big applause to this amazing panel. Catherine, for the moderation, many thanks. Yeah, I don't know how you feel. I leave the room with a lot of questions. But I expected this, quite frankly, because you described very eloquently that we are on a journey of learning, of experimentation. We are tapping into the known unknown, something like that. And certainly you have raised many important issues that we as a company in actually supporting countries, societies, and people that we should bear in mind. And also to give us an idea what might be additionally needed. I leave the room with a sense of urgency, quite frankly. Why? Because apparently change is happening so rapidly that I was wondering whether some of the observable incremental approaches in the public sector with respect to creating rules and regulations, whether this is really commensurate with the type of challenge that we have to address. Quite recently I was in a debate where somebody said, yeah, we are now better in designing laws. Partially, because partially the technology that changes and the laws addresses technology, this is quicker than the changes that we can actually implement in laws. No? This also takes time in functioning democracies. So sense of urgency, certainly incremental approaches are not fit for purpose. Big question, how do we scale it up? And then the last round of questions, actually, I started to ask myself, so how can we actually build up systems that can actually balance power and give people a voice? Because even if we create a new institution, if we have to create new laws, it's going to take normally ages. No? So it takes a long time. So watchdogs are needed. Empowerment is needed, but at large, not only piloting, but really empowerment of people, organizations, nations, really, to get to deal with those issues more forcefully. So many things that we have to do at the same time. And I was asking myself, because when we started our international cooperation many, many years ago, we always spoke about the basic needs that people need, food, water, housing. Nowadays, one has to say, actually, when we listen to you, one of those basic needs may be actually this type of sufficient literacy in this field, really to have a voice and to protect the rights, to access the rights, and actually that their own data is not being misused and that one gets sufficient access to the new opportunities. So a couple of things that I took from your wonderful deliberations and answers to our questions. And again, a big thank for my side. This was an inspiring afternoon. I hope you enjoyed it as I did it, and those that are being online. And I think this was a wonderful close for our very busy week. It gave us a lot of food for thought for the upcoming weekend. Thank you so much.
Yes, Ingrid, thank you very much. Actually, we know that you had an incredibly busy week, and we really appreciate you being here with us. My thanks also, of course, to this incredible panel. I learned a lot. I had a really great and inspiring discussion with you, almost 800 people watching us online. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. This event is almost over, but obviously the work just starts, and also the event series is not over. So there will be another event more focusing on the role of AI within GIZ, which is being organized by the Data Service Center together with the Data Lab in a bigger framework organized by the Academy on the 7th of November in Bonn, where we look at providing our colleagues with a basic understanding of AI, etc. And again, big thank you, but also a big thank you to my team. It was an incredible waving, Vanessa, job you did in setting this up, organizing this in the middle of summer break, and really doing everything from buying bread rolls to doing the really technical content of the questions. Big thanks to Vanessa Hochwal, Karina Kosmokambetova, Varun Pandey, and Robin Nubok. Thank you very much for your support. So with that... also the technical team, and with that, I wish you a beautiful weekend and looking forward to working together with you in the future. Thanks.